Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with African-American dance company Dimensions Dance Theater. Founding artistic director Deborah Vaughn joins me in studio, along with choreographer LaTanya Tigner. They're celebrating their 45th anniversary season. From Three Girls Theater Company, I'll meet with playwright A.J. Baker and lead actress Sally Dana to discuss the brand new play, Disruption, a timely and darkly comic, fast-paced tale of sexual harassment, a miracle drug, social media, and corporate espionage set in Silicon Valley. It's at Z Below through the end of the month. And we're looking ahead to more from the San Francisco International Film Festival. I'll be talking with three makers of short films, one of the most popular genres at most film festivals. Bradley Smith is the director of 49 Mile Scenic Drive, a 10-minute documentary about the scenic road tour through most of San Francisco. You'll no doubt have seen those signs. Kate McLean, who directed Marty, about a mother and son's encounter at a funeral home. And Leah Nichols, director of the animated short 73 Questions, about a longtime San Francisco resident who offers some sage and sincere advice for all of those who love the Bay. Plus, Peter Robinson, our regular contributor and critic at large, reviews the political satirical comedy, The Death of Stalin, and will offer us some details about the upcoming program of music and lectures at Humanities West titled Lucrezia's Family, the Renaissance Borgia Dynasty, which will be held in early May at the Marines Memorial Theater here in San Francisco. Stay with us. In honor of its 45th anniversary, Dimensions Dance Theater is pleased to announce a celebratory program to take place at the Malonga Casklord Center for the Arts in Oakland on this Friday and Saturday. Highlights include two world premieres, a dance representing voices of the homeless, commissioned by the company and choreographed by company member LaTanya Tigner, and a dance inspired by the life and legacy of Harriet Tubman, choreographed by former company member Andrea Vonnie Lee. The evening will conclude with a remount of Tigner's acclaimed second-line dance parade, St. Anne and North Rampart. As I mentioned, the co-founder and artistic director of the company joins me, Deborah Vaughn. She's held reign at the group for its entire 4.5 decades of its existence. Under her directorship, they've been performing dances that really focus on all sorts of African-inspired dances, winning many awards along the way. Deborah, welcome to Open Air.
Good morning, and thank you, David, for having us.
Of course, and she's joined by LaTanya Tigner, aforementioned, who has performed with Dimensions Dance Theater since 1986 and has studied and toured internationally and nationally, performing multidisciplinary works rooted in various African dance forms. She currently teaches at Contra Costa College and UC Berkeley, as well as other theater companies. She has choreographed for dance companies and winning many awards along the way as well. LaTanya, looking forward to hearing about your work today.
Thank you very much.
Of course. Well, we got to talk about this this legacy. I mean, 45 years of history here, Deborah, and you're the leader of it all. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
How did it all start? Take us back, if you can.
It's been a ride. Again, the company started 45 years ago, and it really began with three of us, Ellender Barnes, Shirley Brown, and myself. We had been studying dance for quite a while, and we came up under the tutelage of Ruth Beckford. Ruth Beckford was a prodigy of Katherine Dunham. And she introduced us to the philosophy and the dance technique that Katherine Dunham had invented. And while we were studying, what we noticed is that we were not seeing dances from the African diaspora on stage. And we wanted to see dances not only from Africa, but dances were everywhere that Africa had touched. And we wanted to see ourselves on stage. So it began in that way. We were students at Mills College. We were working on our master's degrees. And instead of using the students at Mills, we asked our advisors, was it possible to use the students that we were working with in the community? Eleanor and I were teaching at Berkeley High School. She was in the regular program. I was in an alternative program. And we saw so much talent and potential in those students. And we not only saw the talent and potential in the students, we also noticed how the students begin to change and have a sense of pride about themselves and their culture and also their potential. So our advisors agreed to let us work with these students, and we gave a performance at Berkeley High for our master's thesis, and people continued to ask to see that performance again and again, and that turned into the company. People asked where could they study, could they learn. That turned into the school, and there you have it.
Keep it going. Well, I imagine over the years the number of people in the company has changed. What's tell us a little bit about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there's been several generations of dancers that we have worked with, which has really been a pleasure because one of the things with a dance company, you can't do it alone. And people have to see and understand your vision, want to be part of it, and then also have their vision in terms of how they can contribute and what it does, you know, for them. Because along the way, the company has been able to take the work several different places. I think one of the places that really stood out to people was when the company was invited to Jordan to represent African American dance. And then another instance was the Festival of Tolerance in Germany. And so people, even though they're performing, they saw how they were being appreciated and how people wanted to know more about the culture, the dance, the meaning of the dances. So, it's been a great opportunity to work with artists, to work with different collaborators. And I think that that's one of the main reasons that Dimensions has this longevity.
Mm-hmm. And some special works are being cooked up and ready for this 45th anniversary season. Tell us about the world premieres that we're going to see.
Okay. I am going to let LaTanya tell you about her piece because her piece is the opening piece.
LaTanya Tigner.
Yes, thank you very much. Deborah Vaughn asked me to create my second work for the company. The first one was actually this is the third. We had done a collaboration in 2015 called The Town on Notice, which was addressing the rampant gentrification of Oakland. And one of the characters that I played in that piece, her name was Harriet, and she embodied the homeless population, particularly elder women. And so from that experience of being in that role and experiencing, because we started the piece with everyone in character and I was outside as this homeless person, and the way people approach me in I can't find a word, but disrespected. Didn't see me. And even as I came into the theater, it was this thing that was happening.
It's a tough thing.
Yeah, it really it affected me. And I wanted to see I wanted to talk about that. And so Deborah Vaughn gave me the opportunity to create another work, so I wanted to, like, go deeper into that character and explore that. Not having been homeless myself, I felt I really couldn't speak. I couldn't speak for homeless people, but I could speak from my own perspective as someone who has judged, who has prejudged people I see and deem to be homeless. And as we went into the conversations with the dancers, it started out as one thing, and then the piece took a left turn and said, this is what I want to be. And so we really started to look at how we, as people who have not been homeless, and some of the people who have faced homelessness themselves, how we judge and how we need to change that so that we respect and be humane and human and respectful of people who are dealing with some different circumstances. And so it really forced us to turn inward.
Right.
So the pieces, that's what the piece came to be. So it's that inward look and how this shift. And we've had some really great conversations. And every time we come into rehearsal, it's like, I have a story. So we've, you know, our encounters with our neighbors who are homeless near the Malunga or just in downtown. And we really have changed. Like, personally, we have changed as individuals as a result of going into this work. So that's how the piece developed, and that's how it shifted how we move through the world.
So tell us a little bit about what we will actually see on the stage then. Are you incorporating a little bit of that discomfort level?
Yes. It starts out very, you know, upbeat, but it really takes people, the audience will question how they move through space and through the city and when they encounter people. And it's a direct question. How do you, have you done this, you know? And then we have some really deep stories of personal encounters that the dancers, their stories that they speak to themselves.
That's LaTanya Tigner talking about the commissioned work for Kick High, Turn Fast, celebrating 45 years of dance. One of two works of LaTanya's that will be on this program at the Casca Lord Center in Oakland this Friday and Saturday. One of your works is being reprised as well. Tell us a little bit about the reprise work, St. Anne and North Rampart.
Yes, so that was actually the first commission from Dimensions Dance Theater. And I've been doing research in New Orleans, second line parade and traditions, and its connection to West African and Central African dance through the Congo Square. And so I've been studying and observing second line since 2008, and I go like three times a year to New Orleans to parade, talk with people, be amongst the folks as the, you know, again, as they parade, and really looking at the movement tradition, the movement retention of African dance in those traditions, and then also the structure of the second line parade and how it mirrors that of African funeral rites. And so Deborah asked, she was pulling together, curating a piece called Down Congo Line, and New Orleans having Congo Square and that connection, she asked me to contribute the New Orleans segment. So it goes from, we won't do the funeral rites section, so we're just going to do the celebratory parading segment. And on Saturday night, we'll have a live band, Twilight, members of which we've worked with before in a different iteration, but very excited to have this reprise. And we have a little bit of a surprise in there, too, so I won't spoil it. This theater, in its founding, again, like Deborah said, I wanted to show our dimensions. Like, we can do the modern and the contemporary, we can do the jazz and the ballet, but we also are very rooted in our traditional African dance. And when I came into the company, the structure was jazz, a jazz piece, a modern piece, and we always end it with a traditional African piece. So I'm gonna leave it at that.
Okay. All right. LaTanya Tigner featured prominently for Dimensions Dance 45th Anniversary Celebration. Also here with Deborah Vaughn, founder of the company. What, did you find this company when you were two? You look a bit bigger.
Yeah, I was actually about five.
You look fantastic. My gosh. Also, you're going to have a tribute to the life and legacy of Harriet Tubman. Tell us a little bit about Ain't No Turn Back.
Yes. Andrea has researched Harriet Tubman's life and her contributions, and what she was striving for in this piece was to show Harriet's determination and her selflessness and her willingness to sacrifice her life for others so that they could gain their freedom. So when you look at the piece, it starts with a letter from
Frederick Douglass.
And Frederick is speaking to her and comparing his life to hers, how he's been in front of audiences and he's received applause for, you know, the work that he's doing. But he says to her that she has received none of this, but her work goes on. And just giving her props for continuing her work and helping so many people gain their freedom.
A reminder that Harriet was the 19th century abolitionist, woman suffragist, and conductor on the Underground Railroad. And that'll be a part of the celebration of Dimensions Dance 45th anniversary, including two world premieres. And works by LaTanya Tigner also represented on the program prominently. I should mention that there will be two post-performance events. Following Friday's performance, there'll be a short talk back with the artists. Then on Saturday, the public is invited to gather with the company for some champagne and treats. More information at dimensionsdance.org. Deborah Vaughn, I wish you another 45 years or so of leadership for Dimensions Dance. And LaTanya Tigner, looking forward to see your work.
Thank you so much.
DimensionsDance.org for more information. A little bit of the music from the celebration of 82nd, from the 2013 Ethnic Dance Festival from Tigner's St. Anne and North Rampart to take us out. Still to come on Open Air, three of the shorts directors as part of the San Francisco International Film Festival. Peter Robinson will review the comedy satire film, The Death of Stalin, and more to come here on Open Air. I'm your host, David LaTulippe. Well, next, playwright A.J. Baker joins me in studio, along with actress Sally Dana. The brand new play written by A.J. Baker and produced by and presented by Three Girls Theater is a fast-paced whodunit intent on turning a few tables as it tells a tale of sexual harassment, a metabolic miracle drug about to go public, all set in the fast-paced world of Silicon Valley. It's going to be run through April 28th at Three Girls Theater at Z Below, presented by Three Girls Theater. Three Girls, the number 3girlstheater.org for more information. A.J. Baker is co-founder, artistic director, and resident playwright, and has served as executive producer for all of the company's new works, festivals, and full productions, overseeing the presentation of more than 50 plays and stage readings since 2011. Her own plays winning numerous awards here in San Francisco and New York. AJ is also a partner in the San Francisco law firm Levine and Baker LLP, which sort of informs the work. And she is joined by the lead actress in this production. Welcome to you, AJ, and to you, Sally.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David. It's great to be back on Open Air.
Nice to see you again, too. Now, you began writing this play in the months prior to the 2016 election. So, let's see, how far can we go with that?
Way too far for just a few minutes.
Exactly. So did the outcome and subsequent events further inform the play, perhaps inspiring a revision already?
That's a loaded question, right? Yes, of course. I mean, when I started writing the play, I was very focused in on just what it was like to be a woman and a very high-power woman in Silicon Valley, and how that really differs from what it's like to be a man here, despite all of the supposed changes that we've had. And I really wanted to give people an opportunity to see that from the inside, what the difference is between being a woman who's considered to be exceptional, by which most people think not normal, a man in the same situation that wouldn't be considered to be exceptional, would be considered to be normal. But, of course, in the build-up to the election, it was very discouraging to see just how focused the attention was on, Hillary Clinton's gender, and on just how much misogyny there was still focused on that, and how that part of the discussion just, led to the inevitable result in a lot of ways. But it was very discouraging. And in writing the play over the next year and a half or so, of course, the Me Too movement also came up. And so the original drafts of the play, there was no Me Too movement. There was no way to bring that in. But once it happened, there was no getting around it, that it had to be a really important part of this play. Mm-hmm. And it is. Mm-hmm. It's very important in a unusual, twisty kind of way.
Yeah. Well, in the old cliche of art imitates life, your day job provided fodder for the play.
Yes, it definitely did. As a lawyer, my primary representation is of senior executives and company founders. So I have worked with a lot of these kind of people, both of all genders, and really seen from the inside how different it is to be a woman in this position from being a man in this kind of position. I have a kind of unique view of that, since I represent both kinds of parties.
Well, before we incorporate Sally into the conversation, let's hear a little bit of a dialogue from the play that just exactly talks about those differences from A.J. Baker's play, Disruption.
Can't you be vulnerable every once in a while like the rest of us? Can't you make a mistake?
I have a responsibility to everyone not to fail.
Oh, come on, Andy. Anytime a hotshot CEO gets in trouble, the shareholders always forgive them. Look at Steve Jobs.
Oh, I am nowhere at the level.
All right, fine. Larry Ellison, Michael Dell, Jack Dorsey, there are a million examples.
Listen to yourself, Christine. What do all those CEOs have in common?
They're disruptors. Just like you.
No, not just like me. Boys could be boys before the winds changed, but not anymore. And if you think it's bad for men, I can promise you it'll be 1,000 times worse for women.
That is not how social movements work. Oh. Things are changing.
If you say so.
Oh, come on, Andy.
Once this furor dies down, it'll be back to business as usual. When powerful men screw up, it'll be because they're just human. When powerful women screw up, it'll be because they're just women.
Heather Gordon and my guest Sally Dunn in that clip from Disruption by A.J. Baker, also joining me in studio. Powerful stuff. it's hitting nails on the head, so to speak.
Yes, and this conversation is between Sally Dana, who plays Dr. Andrea Powell, who is the woman who has been accused of sexual harassment and is the CEO of a very fast, very hotshot pharma company, and her chief of staff. That's Heather Gordon, who is playing Chris Friend, the chief of staff.
Okay.
So that's what you've heard there.
And the shoe is on the other foot, so to speak, in terms of the what we usually hear from the harassment front.
Yeah, so. I don't know. How much can we give away here, AJ?
We have to be
just
pretty
tell me to
careful
shut up
because
if I
it's
say too
definitely
much.
There's definitely one twist after another, and yeah. Part of the fun of it, I think, is that it moves extremely fast, and the audience needs to be following every clue to figure out what the
my
real
character talks is. Much faster than I do, and it's exhausting.
Not much faster than me.
That's true. I know. I can't. Yeah. Very Rosalind Russell, clip clip clip. And which is a lot of fun.
Right.
And actually, the very first line of that clip is sort of my mantra, because she does have a responsibility to everyone not to fail. The hundreds of employees at Gene Farm, the investors, the board of directors, and her family, and that's, I think, what she's dealing with. She does fail her family. She's dealing with a tragedy that happens, and I don't want to give so much away.
Right. Well, she's juggling all of these different parts of her life in ways that frequently men in that position don't have to juggle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, the perception of her juggling is very different than if she was an Andrew instead of an Andrea.
Right. Mm-hmm. In that very brief clip, we did hear one of the key words, disruptive. Mm-hmm. I mean, every new product in Silicon Valley has to be disruptive, hence the title of your play as well, Disruption.
There's actually a lot of different levels of disruption in this story. It's not only what the company itself is trying to do, which is, again, we won't give it away, which is quite disruptive, but it's her presence, it's the disruptive behavior of how she got to where she is, or how we come to this situation, and just the very all the different elements of disruption that go into working in this kind of corporate environment.
And the disruptive of being out of control. She is someone who is always in control. She knows what everyone's thinking. She's one step ahead of everyone, except not anymore. Yeah.
Major.
One thing she says at one point is that we're playing three-dimensional chess here. And I think that that is one of the reasons why there's so many different levels. It's not only different levels of disruption, but different levels of strategizing to try to get to the goal here. Again, without giving away what happens.
So fast-paced. AJ, is that also inspired by what you've been witnessing? Or are you a big Aaron Sorkin fan? Or
Oh, how nice of you to say. Oh, yes, Aaron Sorkin and I are close friends. No. The truth is that in this kind of scenario, I mean, the play actually takes place during a one-day mediation session, which is not a formal court session, but it's an opportunity for parties that might go to court to try to resolve things in advance. And so they only have one day for it, and it has to be finished by the time they leave. So on top of everything else, they have to actually work really fast to figure out what's going on, how to solve it, and where things might end up before the end of the day. Otherwise, all of this is going to go public. It's going to disrupt everything for the company and for Dr. Powell on the outside, not just on the inside. So that's where we are with that. And, you know, it's very that's why we're moving so very quickly for the day during the day, because the stakes are high and the time is short.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about...
And that's
please.
True to life, by the way. That's a very true to life situation.
I know people who have burnt out that way from personal experience, indeed. So fast-paced, but also darkly comic. Let's talk about the comedic element of all this. Sally?
Sally, you want to say something about it?
You know, I just think a lot of it is you're taken by surprise. You think something's going to happen, and you go down this road. And how do you respond to that? The reaction is... To be honest, sometimes people will laugh where the actors do not think, oh my gosh, is that funny? And we have a wonderful director, Louis Parnell, who you don't wait for laughs. You keep going. You just keep going. And you don't play the comedy. You play the truth. And that's really where we find the humor comes from, you know, just being really honest about what's going on.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought up Louis. Our director is Louis Parnell has an amazing vision for making this kind of thing happen. And he really looked at the play and said, we're going to just keep going like a bullet train to who knows where, and the actors will the audience will hear the comedy. And I think that's the case. The audience will hear it. But there's a lot of it is very ironic. It is... in, you know, the darkness of it is more in just acknowledging that this is reality. And, you know, we're not making fun of reality, but there are some points that just seem absurd by nature of what they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's in our life right now, period.
Yeah.
In our day-to-day life right now, period.
So will there be a disruption, too, after we see what how the rest of this year pans out?
You tell me, David.
Well, I'm also curious... You know, great crises inspire art. So, is there something that's perhaps percolating down the road for you as a result of what we're witnessing on the world stage right now?
You bet.
Okay. Well, consider that a future invitation, AJ. Keep us informed. AJ Baker is the playwright of Disruption, which mines dark comedy out of Silicon Valley, and our collective hashtag, and I'm not going to say pound me too, hashtag me too. I still knew what is it, a pound? I don't know what it is, hashtag. What do I know?
Come
from
to
hashtag?
The play to find out what David's talking about.
ThreeGirlsTheater.org for more information. The show runs through April 28th. Featuring Sally Dana. Thanks for coming in, Sally.
Thank you very much.
And AJ, I'm going to keep you to coming back.
I look forward to it.
Again, more information at the number 3 Girls Theater, Theater RE, 3girlstheater.org, about Disruption. That music is inevitable to announce something to do with the world of film. Maybe not 21st or 2nd century Fox, but here are some numbers for you. There'll be a quiz later, so write these down. By the time it's over in, let's see, 5 days, more than 200 films will be screened, or close to 200, in the 61st festival, San Francisco International Film Festival. 4 different shorts programs. 3 of the directors join me now in studio. Got all those numbers now? Well, I'll give you some more before our time is out. We're going to be talking with Kate McLean, who is the co-director and producer of the film Marty. She's a filmmaker living and producing here in San Francisco. She has co-directed a number of short documentaries and produced Jamie Meltzer's award-winning documentary, True Conviction, which tells the story of a group of exonerated men who formed their own detective agencies. She's also the producer of Jason Susberg's and David Alvarado's film Bill Nye, Science Guy and The Immortalists. Kate's live-action film takes a humorous mother-son visit to a funeral home. Kate, welcome to Open Air. Let me find your mic here. There we are.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. The next film we're going to be talking about is 73 Questions, a colorful animation that inverts the pop culture trope of celebrity interview and uses it to create a soulful profile of a longtime San Francisco resident. It will be screened Sunday afternoon at 3 at the Roxy, and the filmmaker joins me here in studio for that. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
Sure. And we need to also introduce our third filmmaker, which I have somewhere around here, for 49-mile Scenic Drive, about those signs that you see and sometimes we'll learn don't see and why we don't see them that have had to do with the 49-mile Scenic Drive here in San Francisco. Bradley Smith joins me in studio to talk about that. Bradley, welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Sure. I'll get your mic on there. And I'm sorry, Kate McLean, I forgot to mention your name in the introductions here. Well, let's start. Let's go left to right here. Oops, I'm sorry. I've got the wrong microphone on there. There we go. That's better. All right, we should have your mic up now properly. We've had the other studio mic on for a second there. So let's go. Director of Marty, Kate McLean. Sorry, and I'm sorry, Leah Nichols. Getting all my names messed up here. Kate, I really enjoyed the humorous aspect of this film, and I'm wondering whether it's first of all, talk about this visit that a mother and son go to a funeral home. It's almost like, sounds like a setup to a joke, and it becomes kind of playful that way as well.
Absolutely. It's a super weird little film that was shot in a single weekend. I co-directed it with my frequent creative collaborator Mario Ferloni, who couldn't be here with me, but what we were hoping to do is sort of take that uncomfortable moment of making final arrangements for a loved one and sit with the barrage of weird emotions that come up in that space and time. And we were lucky enough to find a great funeral home here in Oakland, Colonial Chapel over in East Oakland, that let us use their facility for a weekend and just kind of fully explore this weird, darkly comedic concept. And it was a lot of fun, so I hope you'll come and see it.
Well, tell us a little bit about the quirkiness of this funeral director that the mother and son meet.
Well, I'm a documentary filmmaker by training and for the most part, and this is a fictional film. But a while ago, I happened to be talking to a friend of a friend who had mentioned making final arrangements for a somewhat estranged parent. And as I heard this conversation, it was a small town, and there was a funeral home where clearly, like, the funeral director was the only guy in town. And he was lacking in some social graces and was a total character. And I just sort of started transcribing the conversation that was being recounted to me and said, can I write a little premise around this with my creative collaborator, Mario? And I was given permission, and off we went. And it is just sort of remarkable how wrong you can get it in this very difficult moment with people, how many wrong things can be said, and how much squirming everyone has to do. So that's kind of essentially the premise of the film.
And is the title Marty referring to the, and this is interesting as well, the person that who hasn't quite died yet?
Yes, it's the name of the soon-to-be deceased person for whom the arrangements are being made.
Inspired by real life?
Inspired by like a little kernel of truth in the experience of a friend of a friend, and then sort of a fictionalized wrapper that we wrote around it to kind of give it a beginning, a middle, and an end.
So a quasi-documentary.
Yeah, absolutely. Voiced by actors and, with a lot of, creative freedoms taken.
Marty will be screened on Sunday at 8 p.m. at the Roxy Theater, along with 49 Mile Scenic Drive, which we'll talk about in just a moment. My misintroduction now will be corrected. Leah Nichols, San Francisco-based designer and filmmaker whose background in architecture and urban design informs her urban scale interests, such as neighborhood change and public space. Leah, welcome once again to you.
Hey there.
So I was really intrigued by this film. This is what an animated sort of film. Describe the type of animation that we're seeing. I love that. Is there a descriptive title for that type of animation?
Very tedious is the name. I knew what look I wanted it to have, which is kind of very whimsical, colorful, and lively, before I perhaps knew the technical finesse and time that it would take to make it. But it is hand-drawn stop-motion animation. And it's actually traced over live-action footage, which that technique is called rotoscoping.
Interesting, yeah. So what is interesting to me about this film, and again, everyone thinks, oh, short film, must have been easy to make. There's lots of man-hours that have to go into any kind of production, and perhaps you want to give a shout-out to some of the people that are involved in this stop-motion.
Yes. In this case, it was woman hours that went into it. I actually counted the number of hours because it's just bananas like that. But yeah, it took many hours. It took about 650 hours to hand animate. And it was just me and my two hands.
That's amazing. Now, 73 questions is basically you're asking this person 73 questions. Tell us about Steve.
So Steve is, what do I say about Steve? He is a complete character. He's been a resident of San Francisco for over 40 years. Basically the film is a 73-question interview with Steve as we walk from where he lives in the Tenderloin neighborhood to where he hangs out on an almost daily basis in the Mission, which is also where I live. I met Steve through a mutual friend named Fred, and unfortunately Fred passed away 2 years ago. Fred, we called the mayor of Cap Street. He was homeless. He was always outside in the same spot. And when he passed away, there was a big sidewalk memorial service. And, Fred was the most consistent presence in my life at that time. I was devastated. And, that's where I met Steve. And this project has been a great collaboration between people. I always want to acknowledge between people of different levels of privilege, access, and knowledge. And I would say it's not even just a collaboration, it's a friendship. And on a larger scale, hopefully an opportunity to foster this neighborhood community that Fred actually did quite naturally.
Mm. And the way that you do this through animation, I think it creates a much more sympathetic view of this person than if you had just followed this guy around with the camera. I think that's your intention, isn't it?
Definitely. It was not the initial intention. Actually, it's only animated because the live action footage was so terrible at first. So blessing in disguise is a great lesson.
That's interesting. And yet you did. I'm going to give away a little tidbit of it. We do see an actual frame or two of the real Steve on the streets of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating work, Leah. Thank you so much for bringing it to our attention.
Thank you.
And you can catch 73 Questions and the afternoon program at the Roxy Theater in the Shorts 3 program this Sunday at 3 at the Roxy Theater. Our third filmmaker, Bradley Smith, is the director of 49 Mile Scenic Drive. Bradley, let's have a little talk about this drive. What intrigued you to even begin this?
So this project started with my creative partner, Alex, who is the writer, narrator, and illustrator of the film. And he had noticed that the 49 Mile Scenic Drive had two different versions of the sign that were almost the same. And he's a walker, he loves walking, and he's a illustrator and designer, and he just kind of piqued his curiosity. From then on, it went into kind of just being a short film that was a design critique and commentary between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start doing research, and the whole bottom opens up, and we found out that the man Rex May, who made the iconic version from 1954...
Let's describe that sign so people... most San Franciscans will know what that looks like, but it's the iconic seagull rectangular sign with 49-mile scenic drive, strategically placed, we should say, and that importantly, spaced lettering and very careful attention to the way things are incorporated into that sign.
Yeah, he painted it by hand and submitted it to the city and won a contest in 1954 to have it become the design for the city. And he was an artist, and everything he touched, he had a wonderful and joyous touch to the cards he made. He did dioramas that are in the Mexican Museum's collection. His timeline of his life from when he was in hospice is in the Oakland Museum. And we kind of just really get into this guy looked at colors and incorporated colors from the city of San Francisco and then again put the seagull, which I think if you look up and look around in San Francisco, you see a lot of. So,
some very, very clever and beautiful filmmaking going on in that film. And again, your critique, part of the critique was inevitably, since 1953 or so, some signs would disappear, some signs would be stolen, and the lack of wisdom on the part of the sign replacers resulted in some signs that just were not artistic at all, but were trying to incorporate some of this beautiful design back into it, but failed miserably.
Well, I want to give the SFMTA some credit. We couldn't really figure out the exact point at why and when the sign changed. We know it was sometime in the 90s, and we've called the manufacturer, we've talked to the SFMTA multiple times, and then in going to the sign shop and really seeing how the people work who put up all the stuff that we see every day, it was a fascinating journey to go on how they look at building, how we move around the city.
It's given me not only inspiration to pay more attention to the signage, but to actually take the 49-mile drive for a change.
Well, the SFMTA wants to specifically encourage biking and busing and maybe micro tours where you walk to keep our city moving and green. They wanted me to say that.
Very nice. Well, I'll personally take my bike. How's that?
They'll be very happy.
Nice 49-mile.
Or the Muni.
True enough. Bradley Smith's 49-mile scenic drive will be part of the 8 p.m. Shorts presentation at the Roxy. That'll be screened along with several other films, as well as Marty by Kate McLean, my guest as well. Leah Nichols' 73 Questions, part of the animation Shorts 3 program at the Roxy Theater Sunday afternoon. Two other Shorts programs are also available for your perusal. You can get all the details at sffilm.org. Thank you guys so much for coming in, and I'm so glad I had a chance to see them outside of the context of the rest of them. They really got me, piqued my curiosity. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Sure. Lots to go still for the remaining days of the San Francisco International Film Festival. More information at sffilm.org. Dramatic music from the soundtrack from The Death of Stalin, which will also incorporate some Mozart. Mozart featured prominently in the darkly satirical comedy The Death of Stalin. Peter Robinson here to tell us all about it. That was a surprise to me to hear that this is going to be a satire and a comedy.
Well, I think you're right, David. Hi, and good to be here. And we are talking about the movie The Death of Stalin. And the reason we're listening to Mozart is that the opening scene is Stalin with his cabinet, I'm going to call them a cabinet of thugs, enjoying a concert on the radio, which Stalin is intrigued with. And in fact, it's a piano concerto by Mozart, number 23. And he suddenly decides by the end of the piano concerto that immediately he wants a recording of that particular playing, and he wants it, as Stalin always did, he wants it immediately. So here we have the tension going, a beautiful piece of music, but we're actually in a room. The year is 1953, and the great dictator, I'm going to use great in the really wide sense, not only enjoyed the performance, but now wants it. And of course, tragedy happens because they did not record the actual piece he'd been listening to. And that, of course, is the beginning of a story. They have to find a standby conductor because the other guy is overwhelmed. They pull him out of his bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. He turns up with an orchestra in a dressing gown and starts conducting. And at the keyboard, or playing the concerto, is Maria Yudina, the great pianist Maria Yudina, played by Olga Kirilenko. And she has very mixed emotions about Stalin, and she puts a little note in with the recording saying that she'll pray for him for all the deaths he's caused in Russia. So off we go. Now, take those two words, black comedy, or take the word satire, because most of the cast are actually British. And they actually remind me a little bit of Monty Python. In fact, Michael Palin is in the cast, who was one of the original Pythons. So we have British accents. There's no attempt really to do what Soviets or Russians may sound like. And straight away you realize that although Stalin is at the helm, he's getting old and people are rallying for their position in the post-Stalin era. So this is very much a Cold War movie, and it's a battle or intrigue. If you could imagine, for example, seeing Richard III, where all the nobility around the king are now looking for what happens next. In terms of was it funny, I've got to say that I did not laugh as much as the rest of the audience. They say that a satirist hunts with the hounds, the humorous runs with the hares. And I think in this case, we're seeing a very black, very dark period in Russian history, which I think is interesting because the film only played once in Russia, then the next thing it was banned. And the only people who seem to love Stalin are his son and daughter. So for a second, I flashed across the Atlantic back to our intrigues going on here in the White House. But I think the movie may well have been a warning to Putin, because the people, when they are finally needed, are literally not available. So who are the people? The people are the doctors. Stalin collapses and they suddenly need to get a doctor. But of course, all the doctors are on the hit list. And that, again, is another aspect of the comedy. The fact that you need to heal and help you are literally either lined up to be shot or sent off to a gulag. I came out of the film towards the end feeling this was a timely warning about the nature of autocracy and the way sycophants pander to the king or pander to the chief, and wondering what it takes to get good or decent advice. And of course, I can remember the outcome in England shortly afterwards. Khrushchev came on a trip and was, in fact, the hero. Now, one of the key actors in this is Beria. He is head of the secret police, or the NKVD, as it was known in those days. And he really is the mastermind, and certainly in recent Russian histories they suggested that he was the one who finally knocked off Stalin, either through suffocation or using a type of indirect heart attacking poison. And he I think captures, in my opinion, the story. Beria is the behind the secret police, and he's behind stealing all the names of the people who are most likely to be knocked off. So you get a story of intrigue, a story which in many ways is scary, but it's also got all the key elements of history put in its place. And whether this makes for a comedy, whether this makes for satire, I think you in the audience have to judge that for yourself.
You mentioned Beria being one of the prominent characters. Simon Russell Beale is in that role. Among the other stars you mentioned, Michael Palin plays the iconic politician-slash-military man Molotov of Cocktail fame. Also in the cast, Steve Buscemi as Khrushchev, and Jeffrey Tambor as Georgi Malenkov. Quite a cast, indeed.
This is quite a cast, and also, as you, if you stay for the credits at the end, you'll see that it's a international production, including France, UK, and Belgium. So Belgium got in on the making of this film. Maybe we're trying to reform and give us the message that the European Union is still in existence.
Indeed. One more cast credit. Andy Gathergood plays citizen bundled into car. So,
that's right.
It's the death of Stalin. Catch it if you can.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to move on to something which at first sounds different, but I'm not so sure it's so totally different. And this is the upcoming program in May at Humanities West. It is a program which enjoys the title Borgia and the Renaissance of Empire in Italy. And what I've got to say is the Borgias, in their own way, were like a 16th century version of Stalin. intrigue. This is the period of history which gave us Niccolò Machiavelli. We're talking about his book, The Prince et le Principe. And certainly one of the philosophies that Machiavelli practiced was the end justifies the means. So we're looking at a family which finally ends up in the Vatican with Alexander VI. But we're also going to be looking at the art and the music so that we get a wide cultural feel for Rome, the states of Italy in the early 16th and moving into the 17th century. And we have an ideal set of lecturers or professors who are going to introduce us to this. So the program kicks up on the Friday evening with a program by Thomas Dandeliste, and he's going to be talking about the Borgias and the Renaissance Empire in Italy. But the same evening, we have music in the House of Borgia. So now we begin to get the cultural background on how this works. And then on the following day, Saturday, we're going to be looking at the art, and we're also going to be looking at some of the papal concubines and the families in the Renaissance Rome. So there was a blend from music to art to, let's get the word right, sex. And there we go, and we're happily in Italy enjoying that as well. And then towards the end of the conference, there is a explanation about how the philosophy behind Machiavelli's Prince was actually applied to the way that these different Borgias ruled. So if you're interested in art, if you're interested in painting, if you're interested in music, and if you're interested in politics, this is a cornucopia of how these different, I want to say, trends and really shades of overlap in terms of culture came to be. The conference is at the Marine Memorial. It's the opening weekend of May. It's called The Borgias and Renaissance of Empire in Italy. And here's a little bit of music just to take you out.
Thank you very much indeed, Peter. It sounds like a wonderful event. Humanities.net for information. Humanities.net. And I should mention that Friday's performance will include some live musical performance by the Gallimaufry Chamber Chorus. Humanitieswest.net, correction on that. The Gallimaufry Chamber Chorus, directed by Shira Kamen, violin, will feature Julie Jeffrey, viola da gamba, and that'll be introduced by Kip Crenna, who's the dramaturg at SF Opera. Again, more information for this going on May 4th and 5th at the Marines Memorial, humanitieswest.net. Little Josquin in the background here from the time of the Borgias. It's open air for this Thursday, April 12th. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. I'm David LaTulipe. You can email me, david@kalw.org, if you've got someone you'd like featured on this program. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for manning the calendar, and he'll be raining cats in and out for open air for us. Archived at kalw.org.